Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to the Washington Weekly Podcast. Joining me on this Friday morning, glad to welcome back Shane Lieberman, Senior Governmental Affairs Advisor with Governmental Affairs U.S. here at UBS. Shane, with so much going on, great to be back on the mic with you. Thank you for dropping by to keep our listeners, our clients informed, and I look forward to covering some timely topics with you on today's episode.
Thank you, Dan. Good to be back with you on this Friday.
So, Shane, a few topics we want to cover with our listeners today, perhaps beginning with the road to November. On Tuesday this past week, six states held primary elections, several of which were widely followed on a national level. What are your takeaways from the known results? I know some results out there still perhaps outstanding. And what would you say are the implications of these results for the November midterms? And just to add to it a bit more, speaking today, what is the likely outcome scenario in November at this point?
Yeah, great question. You know, as you mentioned, there were six states that held primary elections on Tuesday. And of those, not all of them were notable. I think maybe the first notable one would be Iowa, where you have a couple of close House races, but also what could be a marquee Senate election. Ashley Hinson cruised to the Republican nomination for Senate. In the House, on the Democrat side, the election was between kind of a more progressive candidate who was backed by many of the left wing of the party, and the other one who won was a guy named Turek. And he was supported by Chuck Schumer and more kind of establishment Democrats, if you will. And his win kind of signals that this is going to be a very contested race. You know, I think at this point, Ashley Hinton is the favorite to win, the Republican. However, this is probably going to become very competitive, and a lot of money will be spent there. And, you know, I think it's notable that, you know, Democrat primary voters there, you know, in some senses, did themselves a favor in electing the candidate who has a better chance to win versus the one that may have garnered, you know, the most emotional support. So, you know, this was a push and pull between, you know, the quote-unquote establishment and others who often want to push back against the establishment. So I found that to be notable. Another state that caught a lot of attention was California, where you had primaries, you know, not just for House elections, but, you know, the L.A. mayor, the governor. So some big races. You know, voting tabulation is not done in California. It's going to take them a few more days. But right now it looks like current L.A. mayor Karen Bass will be one of the two people who will make it to the final ballot. The second person who is leading in this race is Spencer Pratt, who is a TV person, and he has been on reality TV before. And it would be quite interesting to have him place second and face off against the current mayor. And so it's getting a lot of media attention, and I think worth watching to see how this plays out. The California governor was probably maybe the biggest race. You know, it looks like Javier Becerra is going to be one of the top two finishers, which would get him to the election in November. You may know his name because he used to be a House member for many years, and then he was the Secretary of HHS, Health and Human Services, under Biden. And he kind of skyrocketed about the last week and a half as, you know, others faded away in the race. So I think, you know, it's notable that Republicans seem to have gotten one of their candidates into the runoff. But I think this is still California and the Democrat is heavily favored. But the enthusiasm for Republicans to have a Republican on the ballot for governor may actually help them in some of the down ballot races like the House races, where Democrats are expected to pick up several seats in California. And that leads us to, you know, your question about the House as a whole. Right now, you know, it's close, but Democrats are still favored to win. There are expected to be about 18 races that decide who controls the House. And Democrats will need to win the vast majority of those 18 races to capture the majority, whereas the Republicans will need to only win about, you know, a third or a fourth of those races to maintain their current majority. In the Senate, it's getting real interesting. I think Democrats will pick up North Carolina's seat. If Democrats want to take the majority, remember, they have to have a net gain of four seats. So that's only one. So where are the three others? Democrats, after North Carolina, are looking at Maine to be their second pickup. However, the person leading on the Democrat side, he's not the candidate officially yet, Graham Planter. You know, he is taking a lot of controversy over the past week or so, and there are a lot of questions if he will be able to pull through. So I think Republicans are very enthused about their chances in this race compared to maybe where their enthusiasm level was about a month ago. And if Democrats don't win this race, I don't see how they would capture the majority of the Senate. Other races worth following are going to be Ohio, Alaska, Michigan, maybe New Hampshire, but I think as of today, I give Republicans a little bit of the edge to maintain their majority in the Senate.
Well, some very interesting takeaways accounting for both this week's primary elections as well as the potential outcome scenarios in both the House and Senate comes November. So this is something we'll continue to keep our listeners informed on, how this progresses in the weeks and months ahead leading up to November. If we turn focus to Capitol Hill, I know, Shane, this week Congress returned to Washington with a big backlog of legislative matters to be addressed. What items do you feel will be prioritized, and what's on your radar?
Right. So early this morning, the Senate advanced the second reconciliation bill. Remember, last year there was a reconciliation bill known as the One Big Beautiful Bill. Reconciliation, as a reminder, is the process that allows the Senate to pass certain items with a simple majority rather than the 60 vote threshold to get around a filibuster. And so this second reconciliation bill is focused on funding within the Department of Homeland Security, ICE, and CBP, so immigration enforcement agencies. And this bill provides those two agencies about $70 billion, but it also funds them for the remainder of this fiscal year, but also, you know, through next 3 years, the remainder of President Trump's term. This is in a maneuver to try and avoid these agencies being shut down again for a long period of time. And so this passed the Senate, and the House will take it up next week, hopefully get it to the president's desk by the end of the week. That's their goal. And so that will be a big priority in the House next week. Additionally, you know, there's been a lot of talk about this housing bill that, you know, both the Senate and the House have advanced, but they're competing in differing versions. I think we're going to see a lot of maybe conversations next week between the Senate and House and how to try and advance that, you know, before the end of July. And so that's, I think, a bigger item that's out there that we can expect to see. We may see some movement this summer. The House Armed Services Committee, just after debating all night, advanced a $1.15 trillion defense bill. Now, this is the kind of policy authorization bill, not the actual funding. So it's kind of the first piece of the puzzle when it comes to, you know, how our military operates. And, you know, moving this bill has been a bipartisan affair for over 60 years. And so, you know, while it took a first step in the past 24 hours. This bill will take almost the remainder of the year to probably be passed into law. But it's noteworthy for its size and a lot of the policies it sets forth in it. And so that's definitely a noteworthy item. But I think the rest of the summer is going to be dedicated towards funding other departments and agencies as the new fiscal year starts on October 1st. So a lot of energy will be spent on trying to get ahead of that to avoid another government shutdown on October 1st.
Okay, so Congress has been quite busy over the past few days with more to monitor next week and beyond. So a lot here we can follow up on, Shane. And if we tie Congress into geopolitics, it was interesting this week. We did see the House passed a war powers resolution to limit President Trump's military operations, this in reference to the U.S.-Iran war, which continues at this point, still not really a clear-cut deal in sight. However, it does remain very fluid, a lot of moving parts. What should our listeners know about where this all stands today, along with potential next steps?
Yeah, you know, the president's getting pressure on a number of fronts to resolve this issue. House this week passed a piece of legislation, a concurrent resolution, calling on trying to force President Trump to end the Iran war. Four Republicans joined all House Democrats to advance this. However, some look at this as this development largely as symbolic, since there are, you know, lingering disputes about whether this measure carries the force of law. Also, you know, some people will argue that this is that President Trump's actions do not actually constitute a war, and also may further argue that, you know, U.S. is no longer, you know, running, having planes flying over, having, you know, ships launch missiles. So, you know, to some degree, they would say that the war has ceased. You know, that may not be how it feels, especially as the Straits of Hormuz are still blocked. But, you know, I think you're seeing a lot of banter in the public that is kind of public negotiating. You know, when you see President Trump say he would meet with the Ayatollah and that he, you know, he's in no rush to finish this war and come to an agreement. I think that's a little bit of strategic positioning, right? And he's trying to say, you know, in some degree that, you know, he wants to get a deal, but, you know, we can take time to get it right. I do think some of that timing, though, is that he is trying to show the Iranians that, you know, he's in it for the long haul. I think many Iranians may think back to crisis in the late 70s with the hostages, and, you know, Iranians to some degree, you know, feel like they helped Jimmy Carter be defeated in the 1980 election, and that is a feather in their cap. And so they may be thinking, well, if we hold out long enough, President Trump will be beaten, not himself because he's not up for re-election, but, you know, Republicans, his supporters could be defeated and lose control of the House and Senate. So I think you're seeing some interesting tactics being played out. But, you know, I think while there are negotiations ongoing and those negotiations are moving in the right direction, I'm a little skeptical that we'll still see a resolution to all of this in the coming, you know, hours or days. You know, I think we're more in the week's time frame, but this is so fluid that it can change at any moment.
Okay, well, Shane, very helpful clarity as to where negotiations stand today, how they may progress, and of course, you cited several factors which have influenced these negotiations. So, Shane, thank you again for dropping by on this Friday. Covered a lot of ground here for our listeners, our clients, and do look forward to picking back up with our conversation next week.
Thanks, Tim. Good to be with you. Look forward to next week.
Thank you, Shane. Again, today we've been joined by Shane Lieberman, Senior Governmental Affairs Advisor with Governmental Affairs U.S. here at UBS. And I do want to point you, our listeners, our clients, to the Washington Weekly publication, which is located on ubs.com/Washington Weekly for your reference. From UBS Studios, I'm Dan Cassidy. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG, member FINRA SIPC.